stream today, we're talking about entropy and how it impacts key generation. So welcome. We're going to get into the core of key generation and randomness, all things that can happen when the randomness isn't so random, things go wrong.
This is one of those random things.
Yes,
this is one of those random things that can go wrong.
let's start with intros. I'm Jessica, the executive director, and I'm having technical difficulties. Dirk, do you want to start?
Hi, I'm Dirk Anderson, and a member of the committee here. And I've got about 25 years in information security, 30 years in information security, and applied cryptography, and I'm the least technically smart person on this call today. So I'm looking forward to this as much as anyone else watching it.
I think we're all equally genius level, especially me, since I just did the thing where I had YouTube on loud so I could hear myself, which is always scary. Okay, let's keep going. Thank you, Dirk. We appreciate you being here and for being our committee chair. All right, let's do the committee round tree and then we'll get into our special guest.
Sure, I'll jump in next. Josh McDougall, I'm one of the founding members of C4 and sit proudly on this CCSS committee. And I get to sprinkle random and entropy into game design as well.
All right, Ron?
Yeah, I'm Ron Stoner. I've been in the cryptocurrency industry for over a decade now. Worked at Shapeshift, Casa, Botanix Labs, most recently Category Labs, helping to launch L1 chains, and sit on the committee as well. Wrote the first iteration of the auditor exam for the CCSSA.
Thank God, because updating it, I don't know how you started it from scratch, Ron. So very impressive. Jameson?
Jameson Lopp, I'm the Chief Security Officer at CASA and have been sitting on the advisory committee for several years now.
And today we've got a very special guest. Ethan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Ethan Johnson. I have a consulting company, Next Encrypt, and I've been involved in the crypto space for 7-8 years or so, and broader InfoSec and finance for a lot longer than that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate that. So what I was saying when I cut myself off with my own audio that I was hearing on the side was that we're going to be talking about randomness, entropy. We're going to go through some real failures that have happened and how dangerous this can be and why it is so important to be really careful with the randomness in key generation to make sure that you're not sharing information that you shouldn't. So let's get started. Why don't we talk first a little bit about why entropy fails? Because I think this is something that maybe is considered to be kind of an obvious thing, yet it continues to happen where we have these issues where keys are generated and then they're not generated securely because they're not random enough. So why don't we talk about why computers are bad at being random and humans are bad at being random as well. Josh, you did a really cool presentation on this at our conference in 2019, which was 6 years ago, which is wild. Do you want to get us started a little bit with talking about why randomness is hard? It's hard to be random.
Sure, it is hard to be random. The main problem is that we design computers to actually be very, very literal and very precise in everything they do. We work very hard at that. So it seems counterintuitive, but when you ask a computer to give you something random, it's actually incapable of that in the way you would assume. It can't reach into the void of the universe and pull out something that is unique and unguessable just by asking for it. It actually has to work very hard at creating something that seems to be random. We call it pseudo-random. And how it does that is by pulling in all sorts of different sources of entropy, which are different things, either across the system that it's looking at or different state of things, all sorts of different metrics. So it can't actually just pull out a random number just for the sake of pulling out a random number. it has to take all sorts of different calculations from all over the system that it has access to and use that to present you something random. That's about as high level as I can get, I think, with this. I don't know if someone else wants to jump in.
I have a good example here where if we wanted to do an operation that was random, right? I could ask Jessica, give me a number between 1 and 10. And I could take that number and then I could use it to generate a Bitcoin key pair, right? A public and private address as a result of that. Now, we're already starting to see some issues with this, right? We're limited between the numbers 1 and 10. So very easily guessable. But if I ask Jessica, give me another number, we're now using the human, we're using her brain and her thoughts as the entropy and the randomness process here to generate the number, right? And as we know, humans are repetitive pattern generating machines. We also have implicit bias. So if Jessica says 7, she may purposely not want to say 7 again the next time I ask her for a number. The other thing is, if an attacker looks at this, they can say, well, 1 to 10 is not very big. I could just iterate and generate all of the Bitcoin keys for the numbers 1 to 10. And now it doesn't matter how random Jessica is or what she gives me, somebody else is going to have that same private key, which means my funds are at risk. So it's a very simplified example. And if you're sitting there going through this in your head where you're going, well, I can make it 1 to 100 or 1 to a million, right? And you're increasing your security a little bit, but there's still faults within that system. And in order to get truly random numbers and entropy, a lot of smart people have looked at this and worked on this over the years. And I think that's what we're going to dive into. Because when you see the word random, there's very much the thought in your head that, oh, this is totally random. I'm good to use this. But when it comes to digital value and keys, that's not good enough. And I think that's really the core of what we're going to be getting into.
Yeah, and like one of the things that I think Josh mentioned was that you generally you want some sort of external source, something external from the computer or the system itself, because there is an amazing amount of entropy in the universe. And so if we can only reach out into the universe and just scrape off a smidgen of entropy, then that's usually good enough. And some good examples are, I think one of the most famous ones is, was it Cloudflare? They used like a wall of lava lamps. They don't do this anymore, but for a number of years, they had basically settled on like the best true source of randomness is something like a lava lamp, or even better, a whole bunch of lava lamps that are, fairly randomly, moving these color values around. And that if you, snapshot those colors from a whole wall of them and, turn that into a really, really large number, then it's going to be effectively random. Or if we're talking about, key generation in this space, generally the best practice is you take a pair of casino grade dice and you just throw them a lot of times, because that's getting some real world entropy in where, you're not going to have that human bias to it. As long as you're throwing the dice enough times, you're going to be coming up with a number that is hopefully not biased at all. But that's where I think a lot of the complexity comes into play, is that it's very hard to have a entirely encapsulated system that is also random.
And entropy is really the first step, right? Oh, sorry, Ethan. Entropy is really the first step in this, in that when users are generating keys and using hardware wallets, the saying is entropy is invisible until it fails, and then it's catastrophic. So this is really kind of a transparent process that's happening, I would say, step zero as you're booting up the hardware wallet and going through a key generation process or using a piece of software. This is all very much precursors to that, right? Making sure you have sufficient entropy pools. And a lot of people aren't necessarily thinking about that or auditing it and may take that for granted. Sorry, Ethan.
One of the other fun dimensions of this I always like to stare at is that there's lots of different uses for entropy and randomness, and some of them are not for cryptography. And so some of those uses, like if you're trying to run simulations, you might not be as concerned with that true level of randomness. You just might be more concerned with how quickly it can compute more and more results. And so that's We'll probably go into that a little bit later, but there's lots of things available that might not actually be what you're expecting, when you're using it for cryptographic uses. And that's one of those like pitfall areas that tends to go wrong.
That's true. There are times when you actually want to be able to replay the exact same random sequence. If I go to video games, oh, I want to replay this exact same dungeon again. Well, I'll start with the exact same seed. What is that seed? Ultimately, that seed is the entropy that goes into the random algorithm, pardon me. But we don't usually want to replay cryptographic keys.
Only if you're trying to recover your wallet.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
true.
Dirk, were you going to jump in?
No, I think that's pretty well covered there.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we know that the idea of being something being just random enough is really problematic when we're talking about cryptographic keys. And Ethan, I like that you pointed out that sometimes random enough is good enough depending on the context, but in cryptographic keys, that's not the case. Dirk, do you want to real quickly? We're not going to focus on the CCSS during this entirely. Like, this is just about entropy and key generation as a whole. But I think that since we are C4 and we've got our cryptocurrency security standard committee, it would be helpful to just go into briefly the first aspect, which is 1.01 key generation. Do you want to just touch on that real quick, Dirk?
Except I don't have it up in front of me right now.
Oh, well, I love when I throw things at you so
I
that
know.
you don't. I guess I just always have it on my screen, so I assume. So 1.01, I've got in front, so I can read what it is. It's actor-generated key material, validation of generation methodology, deterministic random bit generator compliance, and entropy pool. So built into the standard, we do have something about complying with a deterministic random bit generator, and then also making sure that the entropy pool is wide enough. Is that
Yeah.
correct? Did you say wide enough?
Yeah.
Big?
Or large enough, or
Large
yeah.
enough?
And yeah, and I think that's one of the thing, right? With the CCSS, it's really pushing us to evaluate how much entropy is actually present, right? Going into that. Like we was already mentioned, right? You can have a really good random number generator, but if you seed it with a small amount of entropy, it doesn't matter. You're gonna wind up, with what are called collisions or the same potential numbers coming up over and over. And so what the CCSS is really pushing for, especially version 9, where it requires documentation around the entire process. So not just, hey, tell me what random number generator or pseudo-random number generator you're using, but how are you doing the entire thing? How are you building your entropy pool? How are you validating your entropy pool and making sure that you have that you're not just using 1 through 10 like Ron said, right? As your entropy pool. So, and I think that traditionally, in a lot of development, right, there's kind of this notion of random enough, right? Things are random enough. If it appears to be random, then that's good. If you're writing a online craps game or some other game, like Josh was talking about, where you just need like the appearance of randomness, that might be fine. But when you're talking about the keys that are actually going to be storing a whole bunch of money, then that's wholly inadequate. And that's really
So,
where we're trying to go with the CCSS, and the current version.
to put it in context, I think part of the problem is that we're dealing with such large numbers that the human brain can't really comprehend it, right? So if you're generating a key that's like 128 or 256 bits, just saying that doesn't sound like much. If you're like taking a source of entropy and say that it has like a billion potential combinations. Like a billion sounds like a really big number to a human, but compared to a 128 or 256-bit number, it's infinitesimally small. And for an attacker with any decent hardware, they can generate billions, if not trillions or quadrillions. Like you can generate so many keys so quickly, even just with something like a modern graphics card, that you really have to be thinking in exponential terms rather than more like human readable terms.
I'm putting a link into the video chat for everyone. Our Cryptocurrency Essentials Committee chair has a really good video on entropy, like from a very basic point of view. So if anyone wants to kind of see that in from another perspective, you can check that out. But why don't we talk about why this is such a problem? I feel like this is so important in this ecosystem in cryptocurrency and cryptographic security in general. And obviously, we're all on this call because we really care about it. I totally agree, Jameson. Like when you talk about this number, it's so big, it's hard to even fathom what that looks like. And I think also it's hard to fathom how this number can be so vital and it really is so important to cryptocurrency and securing our
Well,
assets.
I guess if we compare to the traditional way that we would do finance, we would go to a local bank and sign up and get a username and password with them. And if we ever forget our password or if something happens, we call them and they fix it and we verify our account in other ways, like I talk about my first dog's name or something like that, and that means that they can authorize who I am. Really simple stuff where, we're dealing with a centralized organization. In crypto terms, though, things are slightly different in that, you can create as many accounts in these systems as you want. And those accounts ultimately are secured by this secret number that we make up for each of them. Now, if that secret number, if Ron and I share that secret number, we are ultimately the same account. There's nothing differentiating our account. If all six of us use the exact same, what was your random number earlier, Jessica? Seven? If all
Yes,
of us use
seven.
seven as the only entropy to our randomness, then we all have the exact same account, regardless of our dog's name at birth. We are all the same, we are all the same user. So fundamentally, in this industry, your user account needs to be something secret and big, and it has to be different. So how do we do that? Well, we can try and be humans and write out the 128 bits of randomness that our mind comes up with, or we use these systems to try and find some sort of number that we're comfortable with. And kind of as Ron was alluded to, it's hard to know that you're comfortable with something if it only ever works until it doesn't. So getting this right is critical in this process. And computers are less help than we would assume they are.
Well, and to like your point, when and Ron, you mentioned this earlier, when I said seven, and then you said if I was to ask her for another number, I didn't jump in and shout out another number. You're welcome for that. But in my head, I was thinking four, and I absolutely guarantee that I was filtering out seven kind of automatically because I had already said it. So basically, yeah, your point was proven on that. So we, okay, what else do we want to talk about in this? Like, what is, I guess, true randomness? How do we figure it out? And I know, Jameson, you mentioned Cloudflare. We talked a little bit about Dice. I didn't realize Cloudflare wasn't doing that. I put a link to it in there because it's one of my favorite examples. But what else do we want to talk about with kind of the specifics of like the difference between types of randomness? Do you want to get into true randomness now and how that differs from deterministic randomness?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways you can do this, and we're speaking specifically about RNGs, random number generators. And there's a lot of ways to implement those or to use those, and that can be in software. It can be based off of a random number generator built into your computer. In Linux and Unix operating systems, there's two file paths, dev random and dev uRandom, which you'll see a lot of software and programs use. Big differences between the two, but they're both essentially just spitting out random numbers. There's other ways to do it as well with physical, quantum, and tangible things, where if you're familiar rolling dice with a cold card, hardware wallet, for example, that's a Diceware solution, right? You're the one generating the random numbers. And because you're rolling physical dice, you're not a computer that prone to different types of attacks or things that could reduce your entropy pool. When a computer boots up, when you turn it on for the first time, it has not been running. There has not been a lot of things generated. So at that point, the random number generator starts. And it's a very simplified example, but if you had two of the exact same computer next to each other and turned them on at the same time and said, give me a random number, there is a chance you're going to get the same number back from both of them. So now you're starting to kind of walk down the path of, well, what's true randomness versus pseudo randomness? And how can I verify that? What goes into all these random number generators? And that's where it starts to get really, really deep and technical nuance between them.
And that's why we talk a lot about entropy and kind of where things can go wrong. Like Ron said, right? You turn on two computers at the same time, it takes a while for most systems to actually build up a pool of entropy that can be used to generate randomness. And similarly, in this world where everything exists in the cloud now, everything's virtual, right? If you clone a computer, a virtual machine that you've got out in the cloud, and then just clone it, copy it over, and start a new one. If you don't actually take care to reseed the randomness on that new VM, it will have exactly the same pool of entropy as the one as it did in when you cloned it. And so, if somebody else has access to that clone, again, you can be putting your entropy at risk. So, there's lots of little things that you have to be aware of and be paying attention to. And again, that's why with the CCSS, we're really pushing now for comprehensive understanding and documentation around the randomness process for key generation.
Josh, are you
I guess
starting?
to be like really specific about some of these problems, some entropy on a system could be the amount of CPU being used, the amount of RAM being used, the amount of network traffic. So if you take a cold laptop, let's say you've got a notebook set up to be your cold storage device, and you boot that on, it's probably using roughly the exact same amount of CPU that another cold storage system is using. It's probably not using a lot of RAM, and it's using absolutely no network. So if we take, and maybe heat is the other element that it's looking at, what's the temperature of the machine? So now if you've got the same person, in the same place in the world, with these exact same metrics on a machine that you think like, okay, CPU is between 0 and 100. Great, that's a big metric. No, it's between like 4% and 5% on a regular basis or something like that. So we think like optimistically, like, oh, these entropy sources are big and vast, when in reality, the actual metric they come back with ends up being very small. So that's when we say like, oh, the entropy sources on this machine might be the exact same. This is why, because they're very like real world actual things that are measured, which could end up being the exact same across these different devices.
Okay, thank you. Any Dirk, did you
Maybe,
want to jump in?
yeah, well, I was just going to say maybe we want to like jump in, Jameson or Ethan, maybe talk a little bit about, so what are the solutions to that, right? How do we actually, what tools are there, noise generators and stuff like that are actually used to create a solid pool of entropy, even if you've just booted up your system to go generate some keys. Ethan, you want to maybe talk to that?
Sure. One of the basic things is actually doing the opposite of doing nothing. It's the make sure there is actual activity. Make sure it's not just, doing the bare minimum and doing things as quickly as possible. And it's actually aiming for the opposite. And yeah, there are lots of techniques that are out there that you can find. There's no particular one that I'm going to pick and just say, like, just do this. But yeah, it's something where if you're not thinking about that, you're not approaching it that way, you're definitely setting yourself up for problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Ron, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, when you're looking at your RNGs, knowing the technical differences between them and what is kind of your use case, right? So true RNG, tRNG is one you'll see, and in my mind that's one of the cooler ones because they can be as simple as rolling dice, but there's USB stick solutions for this where it's actually arcing across two metal bars to see when does a spark arc and when does it not, and that's what's writing the ones and zeros. And I challenge, you know, any hacker to go in there and try to influence that Spark arc, essentially, to manipulate the data stream. So that's true randomness, right? When you think about that, you can't influence it. It's based off of the environment. It's a physical component. You'll see PRNG, which are pseudo RNGs, and they're essentially deterministic algorithms, right? We'll talk about one big one here, I think, shortly. But it's fast. It's reproducible. It may be great for statistics, like Monte Carlo simulations. May not be so good for generating private key pairs. You also see CSPRNG, DRBG. Some people term these a little bit differently, but essentially with the DRBG, you're looking at a deterministic random bit generator, and these are random number generators that have been statistically tested and reviewed by institutions like NIST, right? And part of our recommendations is to conform with some of these NIST recommendations on statistical, you know, data randomness and entropy pools overall. And that's what's really driving this. Whether it's an RNG, a TRNG, a PRNG, a combination of the above. We've seen a lot of people try to do some very novel things in this industry to generate randomness. Sometimes it's pretty novel, sometimes it can hurt you because you're effectively shooting yourself in the foot as well.
Yeah, like if you don't fully understand something and you're trying to reinvent the wheel, you're trying to come up with something that's probably not the way to go. Okay, so I put in the chat what the PRNG, TRNG, what those stand for. Dirk, did you want to talk more about that?
I was just going to say, Ethan's comment about making sure the computer isn't doing things. I totally was remembering, it's been a long time since I did this, but in the old days, generating PGP keys and bang, just like randomly banging on your keyboard or just wiggling your mouse around. And it wasn't actually like, again, yeah, it wasn't actually measuring your mouse movement. It was getting your computer to like actually be doing stuff so that the entropy generation and it was actually filling up. And I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
Okay, let's get into. Well, so did we touch on environmental failures? I think you brought that up a little bit, Dirk. Is that correct? Did we talk much about it? Sorry, I'm trying to do the chat at the same time.
Yeah, I think we talked about the low entropy at
Okay.
boot and the VM cloning issue. I don't know if Ron, do you want to touch on containerization issues or if that was another but separate from the stuff or.
I think the biggest ones you want to worry about with environmental failures, the boot time starvation that we kind of talked about, and you know, you can see this on physical systems, but especially inside of virtual machines where they have not been running long enough to generate efficiently random enough entropy. Especially with virtual machines, you know, they're not talking to the base hardware, they're talking through an abstraction layer to be able to do those functions and run the operating system. So it may not have the same speed and bandwidth and connectivity to use some of the hardware hooks as a native operating system would. You know, VM cloning, we talked a little bit about, you're essentially just doing a one-to-one copy of an operating system that's set up. That includes all the configuration, that includes all the memory, everything that's stored in there. And as Dirk said, if you keep cloning and deploying VMs, you can potentially run into entropy issues. And they have built functionality to be able to reseed all of that. Containers use shared entropy pools in some instances, right? If you're in a Kubernetes style world, you may not be using, you know, you may be using a shared entropy or single entropy source for all of your workloads in your containers. So that's a caveat you want to keep in mind. And then the other one is, you know, embedded devices and IoT. And I think hardware wallets would be more of an exception to this, but if you're playing around with microcontrollers, ESP32s, building your own wallets, you want to ensure that, you know, those small devices are great, but they need to have sufficient entropy and random enough entropy because while they're small devices and they're great, they're small devices, right? They don't have tons of horsepower for computing and, you know, in some instances, they may need to offload that random number generation task to a specific chip on the hardware or some other process, external process, because it's not good enough for what we're trying to do essentially. So I think those are the environment variables people want to keep in mind and can really get into weird situations depending on the amount of entropy they're generating.
Ethan, did you want to add to that?
One
Did I see
piece,
you?
yeah, one interesting one related to those VMs to always think about too, or containerization. Whether you've got something centralized related to entropy or you've just got VMs that are sort of point in time, how does that drift and leak over time? This is that thing, you've got your registry of containers, and maybe you're spinning these things up and generating keys in them, in large numbers. Somebody exfiltrates it. They make a copy of it. They squirrel it away because they had a good intention with their backup. That's where something can go catastrophically wrong, also, because somebody on the outside you're not expecting then has the ability to get the same entropy, at least for that first few moments. And so it's those kind of dependencies where that little bit of drift really can go catastrophically wrong, also.
A good point. Yeah.
So maybe we want to talk about a couple of examples where it's gone wrong.
Yep. I'm sure we could come up with a couple. All right. Who wants to do the first example? What are some examples of bad entropy causing leaked private keys?
There was one with the libbitcoin explorer where they had a tool using a seed command, and it was using a mersenne twister. Seeded with a timestamp. And not necessarily advisable to be using things like timestamps and sequential nonces or anything sequential that I can guess, number 1 to 100. Better to combine multiple factors and ensure that you've got true randomness in each part of those factors. But what happened was they were using this tool, and part of the seed for their entropy for the random number generator was timestamps. So when an attacker sees that or can discern that, either by doing their own testing or looking at code or decrypting an application or software and trying to reverse engineer it, once you can figure out the method, if it's not truly random, you can replay the method. And as a result, attackers were able to generate all of the keys through brute force method. And it was close to, I think, $1 million stolen just by enumerating possible timestamps and feeding it through the same process that libbitcoin was using at the time.
I think you did touch on one thing that could be worth going into, where you mentioned, it's best to combine multiple sources of entropy. And correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure there's a lot of caveats, and it really depends on how you do it, but I think of it almost in terms of like a set theory or Venn diagrams, right? Like I said earlier, you want to reach out into the universe and scrape off a little bit of entropy, but say you have like three sources of entropy and two of them are great. They're huge, massive potential variation. And then you add in a third, and it actually, like Ron said, it's just like a timestamp and it's a very tiny amount of entropy. You can basically shoot yourself in the foot and sort of nullify the fact that two of your sources were really, really good.
In our CCSS training course, one of the examples that we cover for this aspect is about Trust Wallet when they had an issue with the amount of entropy because they used a timestamp for seeding, and they then pushed it into production using this, and then of course all of the keys were able to be discovered years later, because people weren't aware of it. But it seems like this is something that does happen. Like, this isn't just a hypothetical. This is something that is and does happen. And I'll tell you, when I was creating our course and finding examples, it wasn't, oh, I can't find an example. It was, oh, there are so many examples. Which one should we pick? Which I think says a lot.
There's an older example of, I want to say it was a blockchain.info wallet, and no shade towards them, but I just remember the community was smaller at the time. We're talking about 10 years ago, but people would be like, "Oh, I just loaded up this wallet for the first time, and I've got 5 Bitcoin. This is amazing, but I don't get it." And then another person would be like, "Hey, I just opened up my wallet and my 5 Bitcoin is missing. Like, what is going on? This is terrible." So there's just this like weird situation where different users were setting up a wallet for the first time, and it was someone else's wallet. But for them, especially Bitcoin was so new, they were like, "Oh, do you just start with a couple? Like, is that how it works? Like this is a normal thing to like get a new wallet and just like get a random amount of Bitcoin in it. This is cool. Okay, I don't understand this, but sure." So it was a really weird situation earlier, and honestly, people had to dig it into it because the it wasn't everyone. It was only some users of the wallet, and they eventually, figured out that okay, it was only people using this specific version of Android, because it actually ended up being an operating system problem that the wallet was using the operating system to call. And in that particular version of Android, there was a problem with random that it wasn't using enough entropy sources or was using them incorrectly. So it was, you know, you can't, it, all the other implementations of this wallet on different operating systems were working fine, but because they didn't necessarily verify their entropy sources, they just said, okay, we'll just use the operating system. It'll probably be good enough. That led to a situation down the road. So there, assumptions can be a very bad thing in this industry when you think like, oh, this will be fine. But that one will always stick out at me just because people are literally opening up their Bitcoin app for the first time and going, oh, I've got a bunch of Bitcoin. This is awesome.
I remember, I think that was one of the first early examples of white hat hacking, though. If I recall correctly, it was Joho. It was this developer who actually ran one of the first mempool explorer pages. And I think that he had stumbled across this and actually ended up sweeping a bunch of wallets that he came across by doing just blockchain analysis and finding weak wallets. And I think he managed to get most of that Bitcoin back to the rightful owners, but basically put on the white hat and took the funds for safekeeping until he could verify who they really belonged to.
I've got one thing quick. Blockchain.info, I believe, is now blockchain.com, correct? And they have a certified system now. So if you're looking for certified systems, one of theirs is, I don't know, I can't vouch for all of them, but I know one of them is, you can check it out. But somebody just put into the chat about the Wintermute exploit, where the vanity address generator they used relied on weak entropy. And this allowed the attacker to brute force the seed and recover the private key. Yes. So there's another one as well.
I actually don't recommend vanity addresses for those that aren't familiar. Like I've had a few where my Bitcoin address had my name, last name Stoner in it, right? And I thought that was really neat that I could give somebody a Bitcoin address with that. Very much, it's a brute force process. It's crunching numbers. It's using random number generators to try to get you addresses that match that string that you want in there. And, you know, they're pretty cool. They're neat to share with your friends. But part of the issue is you're locking into a static string for part of your address, right? So you're removing a lot of entropy and randomness from the process to begin with. And then if you're using a vanity generator that has not implemented RNG correctly, it's just problems on top of problems at that point. So for anybody using vanity addresses, I think they're neat, super cool, but I would suggest not keeping a large amount of digital funds in there if you're not comfortable losing that.
And also, if you don't have an amazing last name like Stoner, then maybe you have less incentive to do so. I don't know. Okay. So yeah, a lot of different examples. Dirk, were you going to jump in? Did I see you unmute, or were you already unmuted?
No, sorry, I just was unmuted. But I was going to say, maybe, you know, talking kind of about doing this and everything. In a way of talking about, you know, what good randomness looks like, maybe we can kind of show, like, I know Ron has a tool for kind of demonstrating what it doesn't look like, right? And the issues with it, and maybe now would be a good time to kind of to do that.
Yeah, let's walk down the bad path first. So hopefully everybody can see my screen and the text is large enough. But I've created a couple Python simple scripts here, which it simplifies the problem, but it's great for demonstration purposes. So we're going to run through a bad entropy example, right? And this is going to relate to Bitcoin private keys, kind of the example we talked about at the top of the call. And this is applicable to the libbitcoin scenario we were just talking about. Why they were using a Mersenne twister, you know, plus the timestamp to seed it. This is just using timestamps, but very relevant to that case itself. So in this script, we're just going to generate some new Bitcoin keys using our current timestamp, and we're going to do 10 of them for 10 seconds. So as we run through it, bam, it's done. And we can now see that we've got timestamps listed for 10 seconds. We are generating addresses here, valid addresses with the private key and the WIF. And because we've only used timestamps to generate the randomness on this, I can replay the function again and say, let's recreate a key from a specific timestamp. Right? We're going to use number 10 as an example. So we're going to take and copy this timestamp and paste it in there. And theoretically, you know, this is going to give us the same address. So when we do that, we see 18BAW ending in DGSF, 18BAW ending in DGSF. So we've created this same exact key pair here by only using timestamps to influence our random number generator.
But that's
the other thing
really important there, Ron, is that it's not the random number generator's fault, right? It's not the algorithm that's being used, right? It's not the, and this is where I think a lot of people kind of like miss the two parts of this whole situation, right? They just think, oh, I've got, you know, this strong random number generator algorithm here. It's going to do great things for me. But that's why there's so much focus now on understanding the entropy and the, how you're seeding that.
Yeah, 100%. If we want to take it a step further, I'm a hacker, I'm an attacker. I now know what you're using for random number generators. I know it's not secure and I want to start stealing money. So I'm going to write a script now that starts brute forcing and generating through all of the timestamps to see what key pairs I get back, right? So we can enter any start date here. We can iterate through as long as we want. I'm going to go ahead and just press enter to use today as a starting point. How many days do we want to generate? We'll say 2 days. We're going to use 14 threads. So I'm using a CPU to brute force this, but a well-motivated and resourced attacker is going to use something like a GPU farm, right? So for 2 days, for every timestamp, we would be generating 172,000 keys. And if we let this thing really start and go, we are already done, right? So we've just combed through 2 days of keys using only timestamp with 14 threads on a CPU. So that took 3.43 seconds. So if I wanted to do a week or a month or a year, right, on a CPU, very practical and doable. If I expand this out and distribute this on the cloud across multiple instances and GPU workers, I'm going to find your private key, right, in secure implementations. So this is just really a demonstration of what this looks like, why it can fail on the bad path, and what attackers are going to be doing to check these addresses and these key pairs and the RNG and the entropy to try to get your money, essentially.
That's such a helpful example to be able to see. I like how the little warning pops up as well. If only that always happened for people when they're using the wrong source of entropy or not enough entropy. Okay. What else do we want to mention? Anything else about how that worked with like timestamp seeds or?
The only thing I would say there is having a good understanding of what is being used for entropy. And when developers are setting up systems, they call a random function, they call a library, they call devurandom or random, and they think that's quote unquote good enough. And it's essentially a false sense of security because it says it's random, it may not be random. You also want to make sure you're not using anything sequential, as we've called out, timestamps, right? The numbers that iterate by one, days of the week, that type of stuff, device identifiers. Those things can all be brute forced or iterated through. And the more sources of good entropy you're including, you know, you're diminishing or you're lowering that risk over time. So when it comes to the bad path, we know that one source of entropy, you know, not using it correctly, not seeding it correctly, not using the right RNG mechanism is going to get you into trouble. On the good side, what we're looking at is we're looking at combining multiple sources of good entropy together to get the final result. And in my mind, you know, I've been in this industry for a while. When I've been at companies and we've generated keys, you know, we weren't using the random function on the hardware wallet to do it, because we didn't necessarily trust that fully. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but if there's ever a backdoor in the random number generator, if there's ever an exploit or an issue in the future, if anybody can ever lean on that as an attack, that could potentially be a problem. And that's why you'll see the recommendation in multi-signature key sets sometimes to use disparate hardware vendors, right? You're not putting all of your eggs in one basket. Trezor generates its keys with its RNG a little bit differently than Ledger may. And Colcard, if you're rolling dice, you're totally sidestepping that process and doing it yourself. So having a mix of those really stops the single point of failure. But entropy is that foundational level that kind of starts that whole thing from the beginning. So when I've done this at other companies, the best way I've seen to do it is, you know, We would flip cards in random orders a bunch of times. We would roll dice. We would have a couple of people involved in the process, so it wasn't just one person. And then we would also take the electrical arc off a true random number generator, like I was saying, to add in some environmental factors. So there's no influence. There's nothing where, I spin the same dice number 15 times, as unlikely as that could be. It can happen statistically. So we're removing all of those risks from that process by doing the happy path of multiple sources of entropy, entropy that has been verified, statistically tested, and vetted, and then really conforming to the recommendations we put in the CCSS from all of our collective experience with it.
As you were talking, I was just looking up, Ron. We've got an example in our agenda for today about Android Bitcoin wallet and the RNG bug. And so I just was looking up what it is. And right away, it started talking about reusing nonces or K value. And I remember when I first started learning about the CCSS and you, Ron, explaining to me what the heck a K value was and how reusing nonces can or K value can be problematic. And that's exactly what happened in this example for the Android Bitcoin wallet. So it's just funny. I saw it in there and then I looked it up and I was like, oh, so like, and that is in our standard. You can look at it. It's, I don't know what S or what requirement it is. Let's see, 105.1 ran or no, dot 10 deterministic random bit generator compliance. And yeah, making sure that the K value is generated securely and not reused. So, anyways, your point about these examples becoming part of the standard is, spot on.
We like to thank the industry for helping make the CCSS as strong as it is.
Absolutely. No shortness of examples. Okay, and then also, I think Ron, you mentioned NIST before, as well, but so we pull from NIST as well and put that into the standard too because there are it's open, anyone can look at that framework. And we quote it in there talking about NIST SP 890A, which talks about the different types of DRGBs, DRBGs, with DRBGs that those acronyms, I tell you, that actually are secure. So there's a few you can read about in the standard. I don't know if we want to go into those exactly. Does anyone want to talk more about that part? No? Okay. That's fine if you don't. I won't make
It
you.
gets pretty technical with the nuance and the difference. I would say start looking at the standard because we make recommendations as to what people should be doing. We know the happy path. And then branch out and look at some of the NIST standards that are wrapped around these to understand what testing was done, what's what are the caveats? Is this truly random and truly secure? Don't just roll your own or install a third-party library and say you're good to go with your randomness. Verify, don't trust is the saying, and that applies to entropy as well.
Unless you're literally rolling your own, like with dice,
Unless you don't
right?
trust yourself to roll the dice.
I got to be careful what I say. Thank you, Derek.
I mean, there is though an interesting human element to that too. And Ron, you mentioned it, but I feel like it deserves pointing out. Multiple people in a process like that can be important. If one person is saying, "Oh, yep, queen, ace, blah blah blah," going through those cards and rhyming out a sentence, that doesn't mean that those are the actual cards they're looking at. And you might have some psychotic person on your team who's actually like rhyming off a sequence of numbers that they've been practicing for a long amount of time. So there's all sorts of fun stuff with entropy that can be a problem. But the important thing is a documented process, and careful not to make assumptions.
And again, coming back to the multiple sources of entropy, right? Like blending multiple sources of entropy so that that any one of them, even if it's compromised in some fashion, doesn't just totally give away the whole key.
Yeah. Ethan, did you want to jump in?
One of the ways I like to actually go about this sort of thing, it's not unique to just this area, but it's making that assumption that it's probably done wrong unless I have a reason of like the how do I know it was done right? And so anytime someone says they took care of it, it's handled, it's the okay, but how do you know? Like, what did you actually do? And it's the heart of that and doing that follow-up to really figure it out. Because it's when you start pushing and pulling the threads, you find the things like the vanity addresses come out of it. And it turns out that something cryptographically strong was actually, fundamentally weakened. It turns out that something that was designed for, not for cryptographic uses, but for other uses of randomization was utilized. Like the part of it is, general purpose systems are getting used to build these things. And unless folks have a reason to gravitate towards the best solution, like whatever they're unconsciously doing might be the thing they grab and use at first. One of the problems I've actually been finding is more like, or one of the things I get scared of the most is the fundamental. One person does like makes that arbitrary decision at some point, and then foundationally things are built on top of that. So it's the library gets reused 100 different ways, and that's where you get the really catastrophic, like, holy crap, what happened? Like, how many places were affected by this even?
And I think you bring up a great point there, the like, or a great segue actually, kind of to, okay, so we've been talking a lot about like how to do these things, like how what's the best process? How do you verify, especially like on an ongoing basis, that what you're doing is being effective, right? So how do you check, because it can get fairly complicated and fairly technical here, as we've said. So what are some ways that that you can actually verify that what you're doing is in fact good, and maybe even build a process to ensure that it's always good, right? That like that something isn't happening along the way to reduce the entropy or reduce the randomness.
Yeah, I really like that you pointed out that like we reuse things or we make these assumptions that something has happened or that because we've been using this, it must be securely generated and we don't need to go back and look at it again. There's that, I think that goes back to what Ron said about trust but verify before you actually do trust, right? Okay, so.
Outside of looking at my balance to make sure that my Bitcoin is still there, is there other ideas you have to check on the effectiveness of my entropy?
Yeah, what do we do? How do we know if our entropy is weak? How do we know if the wallet that we're using is, has securely generated keys that we can trust? Someone make me feel better.
Ethan, you got an idea?
Oh, sure. So this is one of those tricky areas where for a lot of folks and a lot of uses, you don't actually expect to be the person verifying or understanding this. And so this is where even if it is open source or verifiable, you're actually trusting that some other expert or some other ecosystem has actually protected you. So that's part of that trade-off folks really should be thinking about carefully because that's where that can go wrong. And unless you actually understand how to do this or check this, or if you're going and getting a hardware wallet and trusting it, or if you're, a lot of these different systems, you may not even be able to see or yourself actually do that verification. And so it's partially thinking really carefully about like what organizations, what people you're trusting, how likely they were to be that diligent about what they were doing and setting up. That goes down an entire like supply chain and supply chain of supply chain kind of topic. But it makes a huge difference for, who and what you're depending on.
Yeah, well, I mean, this kind of ends up at like the fundamental of almost all computer security is that unfortunately, don't trust, verify is not realistic for most things in this space, because ultimately you can almost go down to like the microscopic level of what is the silicon wafer that is in your device actually doing, and like you can't. Almost nobody can verify that stuff, right? And so I keep coming back to tooting my own horn at Casa, and what we do and what Ron mentioned a while ago is that since you can't really perfectly verify any of these things, the best thing is to use a variety of different sources, a variety of different hardware, software, supply chains. And then what you're really doing is you're greatly reducing the likelihood that they're all compromised.
Yeah, Jameson, to your point, if you super cool a computer, right, it's going to have slower operations or different randomness than running at current operating temperatures. And to his point about disparate hardware, and it's really mitigating your risk. Having an understanding that randomness and entropy can fail And I always like to say security is an onion. It's got multiple layers. So if layer one or two fails, three, four, and five are the one that's really protecting you. So if one of your entropy sources fails or isn't doing its job correctly, source two and three should be stepping in to help mitigate the risk a little bit more, depending on how you're generating and using that. We talked about NIST. They've got the resources and the scientific equipment and the PhDs on staff to go do all of the statistical testing and publish the reporting and stats on that. So end users can look at that, but I always operate in security under assumption that something is going to be compromised. It's a matter of time. What can I do or what can I wrap around that to mitigate the risk? So I don't necessarily care about the white paper that goes into a, I do personally, but an average end user wouldn't be diving into RFCs and white papers and trying to understand necessarily how an RNG works. What they should be doing is using that in complement to other secure RNGs, verifying those through these institutions. And then also, we built this into the CCSS because this is very important to us. So if we're on an audit and we're auditing a company for these types of things, we're checking to see, do you have a documented process? Do you know what random actually means? Or are you just saying it's a random function or we implemented randomness, right? Well, prove it. Let's see the documentation. Let's see the implementation. Can you walk through it a few times, right? Show me that you're getting different information at the end of each of your process and demo the process for me. So as an auditor, I can sit there and I can pick it apart and go, are they actually doing all of this correctly and conforming to the controls and the aspects that we've implemented? Because if they are, then I've got a higher degree of certainty that that data is being randomly generated with correct entropy pools securely, as opposed to somebody that's just kind of doing it fly by night.
Yeah, I 100% Ron. And one of my own little rants in this space is that a lot of crypto companies started building solutions and tools without going back to kind of traditional information security practices. And one of the areas that really comes up a lot is there's this notion in the crypto and blockchain space of like, well, I'm not going to tell anyone how I'm doing it because that's just gives them an attack vector, right? And like it just falls back to like fundamentals of cryptography, right? Like cryptography that is the secret algorithms that aren't being exposed are the ones you never want to use, right? It's only the ones that are exposed that have been tested by lots of different people in lots of different ways and have been attacked, from all different angles. Those are the only ones you want to use. And so when people are like, well, we don't document that, I'm like, there are some things that you don't want to publish, right? Maybe you don't publish the names and addresses of your key holders. That's a good security practice not to publish. But to not have documentation about exactly how you are gathering your entropy, you're relying on the entropy, not the way you're gathering the entropy, right? And so to not have documentation around that is one of those things that I think one of the reasons we put that into the new version of the CSSS, right, is because it's just a real challenge sometimes to validate that.
Another interesting dimension to what we were talking about a little bit earlier with the, use multiple sources of entropy, that also can go hand in hand with multiple signature or, multi-signer systems. You may actually have a source of entropy going into one, a completely different and independent, also a strong source of entropy going into another. Whether you're pushing for MPC or multi-sig, whatever you're actually looking at, you're just getting another layer of strength that even if one of those fails, it doesn't catastrophically make the whole thing go down. Kind of the
That's an
obvious thing, right?
interesting point. You doing that in a compartmented way, where Jameson was mentioning earlier how you can have this, really two out of three really strong entropy sources, and then a third one, like a date, that just like messes up the entire thing. Where using that method that Ethan just mentioned, you could kind of like silo this entropy system with this entropy system with this entropy system. And if let's say one out of the three fails in a two of three multi-sig, that's not so bad at least. And you might at least see signs of that being broken that you can work around.
Again, those layers of controls that Ron mentioned earlier, right?
Exactly.
Okay, well, we actually are over time. We could probably talk
I
about this,
checked.
like Josh, you said, for like 8 hours. So we won't do that today, but maybe we should do another stream in the future on entropy and how to check for this and what questions you should be asking. We are doing a different live stream next week with a number of CCSS auditors who are going to be talking about what kind of questions you should be asking if you're using a custody system or a wallet. Like, where do you even go for that? And then, Josh, you pointed out ceremony.guide. Did you want to mention that?
Yeah, I made a back for that 2019 blockchain training conference talk I gave on key generation and entropy. I created a little website, ceremony.guide. It's just a really fun, but please don't use it for making keys. Oh my God, absolutely not. But use it for understanding how, or for seeing literally how different entropy will affect your key. And if you want to do it with some friends, you'll start to see how you end up creating similar keys at the same time and in similar environments. So it's just a fun little interactive tool for exploring how entropy actually affects keys.
I forgot we were going to show that, and I know we don't have time, so maybe we'll do a follow-up where we get into that a little bit.
I mean, they've got the old BTC content still up as well, so.
Okay, I actually put a link to that in the chat. Yeah. So yeah, you can go to that as well. Okay, well, this hour just flew right by. It's been an hour, right? Yes, okay. It went by very quick, doesn't feel like it. So thank you guys for joining. Thanks for everyone watching. We will probably do follow-ups on this because it is such an important topic and there's a lot to say about it that I don't think we even got to yet. So any parting words from anyone on our panel?
Just want to offer a big thanks to Ethan for joining us today. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And the rest of you guys as well, but whatever.
Yes, thank you, Ethan. And check out Ethan's company, Next Encrypt. He's the founder, and he has a lot of experience. So he's a good person to go to if you've got questions about any of the practices for generating keys and how to keep your crypto safe.
Appreciate it.
Keep it random.
Keep it random, man. All right. Bye, guys. Thank you so much for joining.
Bye.